Good morning, diners and travelers. Thank you for taking the time to check in with Ann and Peter Haig and On the Menu. And good morning, Rabbit.
We have a new opening script. How exciting.
Oh, yeah, something new.
We've been doing the same thing for so long, and now we're freezing our little On the Menu buns off.
Yeah.
I mean, when is this winter going to be over? And it's
not even seems started.
Like it's hardly started yet. We have two more months of it to go. Oh, my goodness gracious me. Brr, brr, brr. But what better time to think about some really wholesome, hearty cooking when we're doing that. And, of course, one of the places you can always go look for that kind of cooking is in various different ethnic cuisines. So we've gathered to the start of today's program three very different, but all equally satisfying ethnic cuisines with absolutely wonderful authors writing great books about them. So we're going to start with Calabria in the toe portion of Italy. Then we're going to move rapidly to the island nation of Ireland off the coast of my native land. And then, just to make it totally complete, we're going to go all the way across the other side of the world to the Indian subcontinent for an authoritative book.
Back up.
about Indian cuisine. So that's our plan for the day. And then a slightly different look at the world of cooking from wonderful Roseanne Gold to finish out the program. So that's what's on the agenda today. So without further ado,
My Calabria. Place in Italy that we've been dying to go to for such a long time. I think it might happen soon, actually, Rabbit, won't it? It's called Calabria, and we're talking to Rosetta Costantino, who has written a totally marvelous book called My Calabria. Welcome to On the Menu, Rosetta.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this is a wonderful book, and you said that you wrote it primarily to get people interested in the region because it's really not trafficked much. I mean, tourists don't go there that much, and you think that there's a lot that they were offering now in modern Calabria.
Yeah, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book. I found that when I would tell people I'm from Calabria, a lot of people would say, what country is that?
Oh, dear.
So for a while, I would just say, oh, I'm from Italy. And they all assumed, and some somewhat fair, I was always from Tuscany or from the north. And then I got to a point, I felt like, wait a minute, people need to know where I'm from. It's a beautiful region. And I felt it was somewhat undiscovered, and I really wanted to write a book. That was one of the reasons. The other reason, of course, was because I felt that I was losing a lot of the traditions.
Oh, so your way of making sure that you didn't lose them was to exercise them by writing them all down?
Yes, because my mom had everything in her head.
Yeah, what's that?
It's the way, you know, I was taught, even when I was a little girl, I would just watch my grandmothers and my mom. And my mom never wrote anything down. And when I was, you know, I was busy working, I had a very demanding job. It was pretty much 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. I really started feeling that I was losing a lot of the old ways, we could say, traditions of cooking. And that's when I felt like I really want to capture all these things, not just for myself and my children, but for the rest of it, because I felt that there were a lot of descendants from immigrants that came in the early
1900s. Oh, from Calabria especially.
From Calabria,
yeah.
Literally, they're literally
yeah. The only place I think that lost as much population to America and Canada was Abruzzo. They're pretty bad too.
Well, I think Sicilia is pretty close too.
Yeah, I guess
I think the three largest ones really from the south were Sicily, Calabria, and Campania.
And Campania.
Most of the immigrants came from there. And I felt after I started doing the cooking classes that there were so many Calabrian descendants who were remembering things like their grandmother used to do, but had nothing also written down.
Well, see,
that was the same thing.
That was
sort of the drive, yeah.
I tried desperately before my grandmother died, because my background's Sicilian, tried to get her, and she thought I was some kind of an idiot that I wanted all this. You're like, how much and how do you know when it's done and that kind of thing.
Yeah, like silly questions, because she never had to ask herself that question, or at least if she did, she had forgotten when that was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From a chronological standpoint, Rosetta, you were born in Calabria and came here as a child?
Yes, we moved here in 74, and I was 14, so now you know how old I am. my big 50 is coming up at the end of the month.
Oh, whoopee. Well, have a wonderful time. I remember my 50th birthday. I never made it to bed. I cleaned up till 4 o'clock in the morning, and then I curled up on the floor.
Oh, wow. Okay. So we moved in 74, and then it was right at the beginning of high school. So I went to high school, and then I went on to UC Berkeley, and I graduated with a chemical engineering degree, and then I ended up working in Silicon Valley. So my career has always been in the high-tech world.
And when did you decide to quit the high-tech community, start teaching cooking?
It was in 2001 when I really felt that I couldn't be the best mom and be the best manager. It was just too much. I mean, my job was demanding, and there was really no need at that point for me to work, so I decided it would be best to work from home. So I actually continued working as a consultant. That's when I started feeling like I want to do something that I really love, that I really enjoy doing. And, of course, it was natural for me to go to cooking, and because it's been with me all my life. It was something that I never really stopped doing.
And you have a wonderful co-writer here in Janet Fletcher. She's wonderful.
Yes. Janet is amazing. I don't think I would have ever been able to get it down in writing because being an engineer and trained as an engineer, I can write a recipe. I can tell you how to do a process step by step. But when it comes down to really get all the stories down and my voice across, I think I would have had a very difficult time. So it was wonderful to have Janet as my co-author.
Now, you have an extended family still, though, right?
In Italy? I mean, in Calabria, yes.
No, but didn't your father set up your garden for you in California?
Oh, yes, yes. My parents are here.
That's what I meant, yes.
So they live only a couple of blocks away.
How often do you go back to Calabria?
Well, I've been going back every year for the past 5 years, either for our own vacation. I mean, we go every other summer, and we alternate with my parents. So my parents went this summer, and I have to stay behind because I have to take care of my garden and their garden while they're gone. And they have rabbits, and I have chickens, so we really can't both go at the same time. But I went also last month because I did my first culinary tour to Calabria.
Oh, you're doing culinary tours, too?
Yes, this was my first one.
How do you like all that babysitting?
Well, no, I was really nervous about doing it. My students have been asking me for years, and I always said, no, I really don't want to do it because I was worried about all I would be doing, be babysitting a bunch of adults. But it was amazing. I had an excellent, the tour operator that we worked with from Calabria was just amazing. And we had the best bus driver you could ask for, and it was so much fun that it never felt like I was working. I felt like I was on vacation with all the students. So we had a blast.
Now tell me how Calabria has changed. I was sharing a story with you from many, many years ago, and you were surprised by it because it's not like that anymore.
I think that what we saw, at least even from what I hear from my parents, they saw a drastic change after the Second War. And I think with roads being built and probably with the television, I mean, a lot of people give credit to the television. The people really got to see what's up there, what was there in the world. And the tourism industry really started growing. So if you really look at the Tyrrhenian coast, even as I remember as a child in the late 60s, along the coast there was very little. But in the 70s, it started booming. And from the 70s, to today, they've just kept on building.
Now, is this Italians or is it Northern Europeans?
They do get a lot of Italians, but a lot of Germans and British. In fact, the Brits are buying all of Scalea and Yamande. Those are two coastal towns near my town.
Yeah, well, they did that in Spain, so.
And they're turning these really, old buildings into beautiful bed and breakfast. And they have really cheap flights from London to La Spezia. So right now, if you go between May and June, that's when most of them come down. You see mainly Germans and British, but you get a lot of Italians also from Northern Italy.
Now, what are some of the things that are characteristic? I mean, we've lost sight of the fact that we're actually talking about a cook, because my Calabria is a story, but it's also a cookbook.
Yes.
So what are some of the things, Rosetta, that make Calabrian cuisine different?
I think what I was able to show, with my culinary tour, is really how simple the food is, but how delicious it is. I was able to share the group that I took with me that we went up in the mountains, the salumis. I mean, the salumis are just phenomenal.
I still remember the one I had.
Yeah.
It was
And fresh.
The rest of my life, I'm trying to find the same sauces. Yeah.
It's hard to find the Calabrian sausage. There's like a spreadable sausage, you know, the andouille.
Yeah.
That you can't find it really outside of Calabria.
What about the one that Chris Cosentino does in San Francisco and in Encanto?
It's not. What I can say is if you've never had andouille, then what he does is great.
Oh, okay.
But
this is good to know.
If you've experienced the real stuff, then you really need to go Calabria to taste the real andouille, this feeling guy. I think a lot of people are trying to make it in the U.S., and I'm hoping that someone will come out with the real thing.
Not yet.
It doesn't compare.
So what else is unique about Calabrian cooking?
You know, even the cheeses are amazing, I think, and they're not known. You know, a lot of people are really not familiar with the cheeses of Calabria. Of course, fresh ricotta. I mean, in southern Italy, you know, you can get it whether you go in Sicily or up in Basilicata. But it's just for people to experience that fresh ricotta and I had them taste the ricotta salata and the ricotta fumicata, which at least out here on the West Coast, we can't get anything similar
really?
To that. Yeah.
You can get it on the East Coast.
Then we had the Caciocavallo Silano, which is the one made up in La Sila Mountains in Calabria. And there's another cheese that I have in the book that if you look at it, it has a knob of butter inside. It's called Butirro.
Oh,
and
my.
I've never seen that outside of Calabria. And now that is the same. The cheese on the outside is the same as the Caciocavallo, so it's a stretched dough. But in the old days, they used to preserve butter that way.
Oh, is that so why? Interesting.
Because of lack of refrigeration. That was the only way they came up with a way to preserve butter. But they've continued to make that cheese even today because it's a traditional cheese. But nowadays, it's eaten as a cheese or as an appetizer.
And your pasta shapes are just amazing.
And the pasta shapes, again, you know, the homemade, there's so many various homemade, handmade pasta shapes that you really don't find, I think, outside of Calabria. I took the students to a fig factory mainly they do confectionery. And just to be able to taste the figs of Calabria, totally different, I think, than anything that, you know, we would get out here.
Well, the thing that amazed me was we were at a restaurant called La Calandre in, where was it? It was north.
It's just outside of Padua.
And right, outside of Padua. And they had this fabulous saffron risotto with, they shaved Calabrian licorice over it.
Oh, yes.
That's another
specialty of Calabria. Yeah.
Oh, it was amazing stuff.
That people are not aware of it. That
it's a root, it wasn't candy.
Has the best licorice in the world. It's world renowned. Then the citrus also. You know, a lot of people are not familiar with the citron, you know, which we call it a cedro, or the bergamot, or the clementines of Calabria.
Yeah, because let's be careful, listeners, to understand from a geographical standpoint that Calabria is as south in mainland Italy as you get. The only thing that's any closer is the Sicily right off the coast. Mm-hmm. So it is much warmer than much of the rest of Italy, giving it the opportunity to be able to grow more of these things. Now, I seem to recall, I don't think I got this from your book, somehow I got it from somebody else, that the Queen of England likes Calabrian licorice.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, yes. In fact, I think that the reason why it took off in the 1800s is because the British wanted that licorice. And initially, what I've been told is that it was used for medicinal purpose.
Well, it's now made into sweets, as we would call it.
Yeah.
And other people would call candy.
In fact, it's pure licorice. I mean, when you go, like, you know, to Amarelli, which is one of the largest one, manufacturer of licorice, you get to see how they make it straight from, you know, the roots.
We saw that when they shaved it onto our risotto.
Yeah.
This is such an incredible book. We're not going to be able to cover this whole book because it's so packed with information, stories, delicious, absolutely delicious recipes and breads. And I just wanted to mention that I was amazed your mother brought her bread starter a natural yeast in her purse when she came over from Italy to California 20 years ago, and is still going?
Yes. In fact, she had heard these horror stories that the bread in America was like sponge. And then eventually I figured it out what they were talking about. They were describing Wonder Bread.
Oh.
And again, things have changed so much from the time we came in 74. We have wonderful bakeries now.
Oh, yes.
But in those days, it was very difficult to get really good, crusty Italian bread. And so she brought it. It was like a golf ball, tennis ball size. And she brought it in her purse. and even to this day, she always, you know, she keeps it every time she makes the bread and always refreshes it so she has it for the next batch.
Unfortunately, the statute of limitations on importing bread starters has expired a long time ago. so you're safe from the USDA. Now, Rosetta, how can people keep in touch with your cooking activities and your tours? You must have a website, I imagine.
I have a website.
Go ahead.
www.cookingwithrosetta.com. I also have a blog. It's www.calabriafromscratch.com.
Oh, that's good. Very
and
creative.
And I've set up a Facebook fan page for my Calabria. So that's where I also have all book signing events. But they're also on my website.
Well, if you're getting into parts of Italy that are somewhat off the beaten track, Calabria is certainly one of those places. And on the menu promised itself, we were going to go last year. We'll promise ourselves again that maybe we'll go next year. We didn't make it this year. We'll be in touch to pick your brain. I hope that's all right,
yeah,
Rosetta.
Definitely. Write to me, but also, you know, in the book there's a good section that I managed to include where there are places to eat and to stay. So I hope people use that as a reference also.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you so much. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ciao.
Thank you for having me. Ciao.
And now a short commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I think you'll be very happy that you rejoined us, because next up we have the wonderful Coleman Andrews, who's always such a treat to interview, and a really astoundingly fine book on country Irish cooking that he did a little while back. And it just makes me want to go there even more and more and more. So let's listen to the Coleman, and you'll start to crave some of that really healthy but substantial cooking. Coleman Andrews, I'm so glad you decided to steer us towards your book, which I don't know how we managed to miss in 2009. The Country Cooking of Ireland, which is probably one of the most handsome books we've ever gotten, on gorgeous photographs, by Christopher Hirschheimer.
Right.
It's an odd name for a woman, isn't it? And did I say that you won all the top beard awards that year for this book?
Actually, this year, 2010, it did win the Best International Cookbook and also the Cookbook of the Year.
We were there.
In May, right?
Yeah, we were there.
No, I don't remember everything that was going on.
I don't know. It was crazy. You've not seen the press room at the Beard Awards for a while.
one thing we should quickly note is that Coleman Andrews is probably making the fastest ever return appearance on the menu.
Yes, because
right.
We...
So, welcome back. And,
nice to be back.
Coleman, we were joking before we came on the air about the fact that within the last few decades, if you had suggested that a book on Irish cooking was going to be very important, people would have said, oh yes, and it would be the smallest book on record.
Exactly.
Shortly after the fine book of English cooking.
Right, and now, of course, that doesn't make sense either.
No.
There are plenty of books on fine English cooking now, all of a sudden.
So you were explaining to us how you discovered this subject. So why don't you tell our listeners that?
Well, just briefly, I was actually, I'd never been to Ireland for no particularly good reason, but I'd been to Scotland and England and, you know, all over Europe, but always missed Ireland. And I was invited one year by the Irish Food Board to come to a seminar they were doing in 2002. And I met somebody there that was a very sort of passionate exponent of Irish food and traditional ingredients. And we ended up doing a story for Sever on him, myself and Christopher, who was our main photographer and my fellow editor at Sever. And that led to us the next year doing another story. And at some point we looked at each other and said, you know, there's enough material here probably for a whole special issue of the magazine. So we did that, and then I still didn't feel I'd covered it all. So I thought, well, maybe I'll try to write a book. As it happened, Chronicle, which publishes beautiful quality cookbooks with great photography and, you know, nice production and everything out of San Francisco, had started a series called the Country Cooking Series, and the first one was France, written by Ann Willen, who I think you've had on the show.
Yes.
And it was a wonderful book. And they asked me if I'd do country cooking of Italy, and I said, yeah, sure I would, but what I'd really like to do is maybe a smaller book first on Ireland. And they said, well, you know what, let's go for it. Why don't you do a big country cooking book on Ireland?
Well, it's certainly not a small book, and it's...
No, it's not. You don't want to drop it on your foot.
It's quite a hunk. Anne was having trouble getting... I had to relieve her. I had to go help her bring it up the stairs. It's kind of heavy. But it's more than just cookbook. I mean, it's a celebration of the foods of Ireland, wouldn't you say?
And particularly the artisanal foods of Ireland.
And the artisanal
traditions of Ireland, I would think.
Mm-hmm, exactly. And you know, that really, I mean, certainly the unkind remarks one would have made, and until fairly recently or even now, and the Irish themselves make them too, there was certainly some justification for that. But on the other hand, there is really, surprisingly, an old, long old food tradition in Ireland. And if you read the old legends and things from hundreds and hundreds of years ago, they're full of accounts of great feasts and heroic eaters, and just that food is very,
well,
very,
I mean, I think that currently, I mean, not currently, but in recent memory, the political strains and the economic strains on Ireland would have sort of camouflaged those traditions, don't you think?
Absolutely right. And in fact, an archaeologist who kind of specializes in the remains of food, you know, cooking pits and things like that, said he encapsulated it very neatly. He said the Irish lost their food traditions when they lost ownership of their land.
Right. You quote that in your book, and I thought that was very poignant.
Yeah, no, it's
but one of the, but one of the things surely that lies at the heart of all this is the larder. What's available in Ireland that's local and that in and of itself is some of the best of its kind in the world. So for those listeners who are not familiar with this tiny little land that has only about 60% of the population it had in 1845, for reasons we won't go into, that there is an availability of product in seafood and in meat and in vegetables.
And particularly in grass, he said.
Grass too, yes.
That's what, again and again, people would make the point that the most important crop they grow is their grass, because it's the climate and the soil give this incredibly nutrient-rich forage material for animals, which means both that the dairy products are absolutely superb. And in fact, Irish butter is now in supermarkets all over America, the Kerrygold butter. Yeah, it's a wonderful product. And I was amused to read in Marcella Hazan's kind of memoir, Amarcord, that she published a couple of years ago.
Right.
She mentioned she had been to Jerina Allen, somebody else you've had on the show, too.
Yeah.
Down to Ballymaloe to the cooking school and discovered Irish butter. And she says that's all she uses in her Italian cooking now.
Yeah.
So, but then beyond that, the meats, the lamb and beef particularly, are really delicious. And, of course, as you say, the seafood, and there's thousands of miles of coastline. And
you know, how is it that they have been saved from all this pollution? Why is it? And one of the standards of seafood there is that it comes out of absolutely the most pristine waters of the world.
It really does. And, I mean, Ireland has comparatively little heavy industry.
So, for example, let's make a comparison. Let's compare Ireland to Japan. Japan has some extraordinarily polluting industries.
Exactly.
That
chunk
things like heavy metals and mercury into the ocean.
Right. Which doesn't really exist either in Ireland.
Ireland
doesn't
have a tradition of that kind of thing at all.
Mm-hmm. The problem that does exist in Ireland increasingly is the freshwater. There's a lot of as farming gets, as larger farms and agribusiness becomes more prominent, it's still not anything like it is in most other countries. But there is contamination of the groundwater there are worries about the trout and salmon stream.
And supposedly, I mean, it's known to be the best in the world, isn't it?
Oh, well, I think, I mean, certainly the smoked salmon, when the smokers were using wild Irish salmon, which now is temporarily, we hope, forbidden, I think it was the best smoked salmon in the world. And the fish itself, the fresh fish, salmon and otherwise, really tends to be very good quality. The Dublin Bay prawn, which is the same creature exactly that you'll know if you're in Italy, that's called scampi.
Yeah.
Those are wonderful.
Everybody raves about those. I peeked it into the Irish cuisine when I lived in Philadelphia because my neighbor was an unusual a Protestant Dubliner. Or a Dubliner Protestant.
Right.
And she was very into natural foods. So, and she came out of that tradition.
Right, yeah, there's a very strong movement in, or feeling in Ireland against genetically modified crops.
Oh, I believe
against
it.
Against the over, you know, use of pesticides. The Green Party is relatively strong there.
Yeah. How did you organize your research of this book? I mean, I'm fascinated because it's so all-encompassing. I don't even know how many years it took you to write it.
Well, I mean, it certainly, I was going back and forth to Ireland for 2 or 3 years and sort of writing as I went. It was a combination of things. One thing is because the island is so small, people tend to know each other. So if you key into a few key food people, a grocer here and a chef there and a cheesemaker there, they know most of the other people that are doing interesting things around the island. So, you know, they would give me introductions and so forth. And beyond that, it was really literally driving around and you'd see something interesting and you'd stop. And the Irish are not exactly standoffish. They're extremely friendly people. And almost, I think, without exception, they go up and knock on somebody's door and say, hey, we saw that looks like you make cheese back there. Is that true? Yeah, well, come in. Where are you from? And, you know, it would go on and on. And the next thing you knew, they were your best friends in the world.
Now, you've got a combination of traditional Irish foods. And are there also more modern interpretations of the same set of ingredients?
There are. I have a few of those recipes, not a lot in my book. And if I had to say what I think the weakness of modern Irish cooking is that unlike in England, I could send you to a dozen restaurants in London where English chefs are, or British chefs, they may be Scottish or whatever, but they are using their the old-fashioned ingredients and old-fashioned traditions and making sort of updated modern food. There's very little of that in Ireland.
Okay,
there's a little bit, but not as much as I wish there were, and I hope there will be someday. No, but what I did that was interesting is I went back the other direction, and I spent time in the National Library in Dublin going through these estate papers, which were often included recipe notebooks, handwritten in sometimes script that was very hard to decipher, but recipes from the 19th and even the 18th century, some of which I found adapted very nicely to.
Yeah, Heston Blumenthal's doing that with English cuisine.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, he has that pub.
He loves that, yeah.
And Bray, and now...
And he's, you know, he's opening a restaurant in London.
Exactly.
Which
we're trying to get in there for February. Yeah. But he is featuring some historic recipes in that restaurant,
exactly,
too.
Exactly. Even at the Fat Duck, he has some things which are based on Victorian-era recipes.
I mean, he had fried beer at the pub.
Yeah.
We never saw that.
I
haven't had that.
That concept escaped me a little bit. Now, there's also a fine vegetable larder, too, of if you like, cool temperate things like leeks.
Leeks, kale,
cabbage,
and of course, let us not forget the famous potato. And I felt bad when I started doing my research about the potato. And all those years with my young daughters who grew up thinking the only vegetable worth eating was the potato. And I think potatoes are, you know, they're worthless. That doesn't count as vegetables. You know, eat something green. Uh-huh. But then I come to find out that potatoes actually are probably one of the most nutritious vegetables in the world. And if you had to, God forbid, but live on only one vegetable, as the Irish did for many of them did for so many years, the potato is probably the best one you could choose.
As long as you eat the skin, right?
Well, yeah, exactly. But,
French fried is not the ideal way.
Now, my Dublin neighbor used to tell me that I'm an honorary Irish because I'm so crazy about potatoes.
And has the book open to a beautiful bunch of asparagus.
Oh, the asparagus is wonderful.
What about shamrock? I never knew you could eat shamrock.
It's not, they say you're eating shamrock. It's not really the same thing as the decorative shamrock.
That was wood sorrel. I have that in my backyard.
Right.
Well, shamrock is clover anyway. I mean, it's just a four-leaf clover.
Well,
and sheep eat it, so I guess you're eating it secondhand when you eat lamb chops.
Exactly right.
Now, are there any recipes in here that you think are really, I mean, there's so many, and there's so much covered in this book, we'll never get through it all. Is there something you'd like to point our listeners to, outstanding, like a real treasure find?
You know, for me, because I have never been a baker, That's a very specific. My wife is a great bread baker. I've never been able to do it, but I forced myself to start trying to learn how to make the Irish soda breads. And soda bread in Ireland is not necessarily bread with raisins in it, and as we think of soda bread here, it just means bread that instead of being risen with yeast, it's risen with a combination of baking soda and buttermilk, and the action between them raises the bread. And I found that actually, before long, I was making pretty good bread, and it was very easy, and it's very forgiving, and it doesn't have to be kneaded, and it's really a kind of thing where you put ingredients in a bowl and mix them until they get to the right consistency, and then bake them at the right temperature, and you've got a really delicious loaf of bread, and you spread some of that Irish butter on it, and all. I mean, that was my big revelation to me, because I know how to make soups and stews and roasts.
Uh-huh.
Been doing that for years.
But. No, and just leafed on by Boxty. Which I guess is...
That's right, the potato pancake, as it were, of Ireland.
Irish latkes.
Exactly.
And earlier on, that wonderful cause of indigestion called Culcannon.
Culcannon, which is all which is very, very healthy.
Essentially fried cabbage.
Exactly, but that kale or cabbage and potatoes mashed together. I made that, actually not this year, last year for Thanksgiving, and everybody was amazed. They never said they'd never had it before. And
in England, it's called Bubble and Squeak.
Yeah, I was going to say, isn't that Bubble and Squeak?
Yeah, for obvious reasons. And you have a wonderful section on rabbit.
Yeah, we love rabbit recipes.
Right, which you know, Americans still have a hard time with.
Not in this house. We love it.
No, that's great. Yeah.
Well, we have to lay our hands on some more rabbits so we can cook some of them.
You have all these interesting sections. Peter said that it's the kind of book he can sit down and read.
Right.
Like school food and what we ate in County Antrim. And all kinds of stuff. And you have information on the, is it Ballymaloe?
Ballymaloe.
Mm-hmm. I never can say that.
Right.
That's an interesting story. I think that's a critical juncture of evolving contemporary cuisine.
Right. Extremely important in Ireland, right? And Well, I mean, to me, and it's the same philosophy we had at Silver Magazine, is that, you know, it's much more interesting when you're eating food if you know something about the place it came from or the people who made it or why it has these ingredients and not those ingredients. And that just adds to my thinking, and I think a lot of people agree with me, it adds a lot to your appreciation of the food and also probably to your ability to cook it right if you know the spirit in which it was made. I really think in some fairly abstract way, it helps you to make it better.
Well, I love the book, and
thank you very much.
It's a wonderful travelogue. It's a history and geography book of this fascinating small country, which we haven't been to, but we already told you before we came on the air.
Right.
We're definitely going to do that, and we're going to use this book as a resource.
Well, let me know when you're going. And
we'll
up to date information.
The Country Cooking of Ireland is the title by Coleman Andrews. And Coleman, how is your web based project going?
It's going full bore.
I got one email about it, and then I haven't seen anything more about it.
All right, yes, it's called thedailymeal.com, and we are very new. We just launched in the middle of October, a shadow of what we will be, but already pretty interesting, I think, and growing fast. And I've had so many other projects and finishing up touring for another book of mine about Ferran Adria and working on galleys for my next book.
Which is The Country Cooking of Italy.
Of Italy, right. But after the first of the year, I'm going to focus full-time on the website.
And what's the mission of the website?
Well, the idea of the website is really to be all things to all people about food and drink. The idea is to be the one site that you'll want to go to, and not because we'll have everything on the site, but because if we don't have things, we'll link you to people that do have them. And so it's a combination of a lot of original material, and then we will select other things to tell you about. We have a huge, huge already custom-built recipe search that draws on about 400 other sites, so you really have, and we have a system for ranking the recipes. And so as I say, it's a work in progress, but there's already a lot of fun little stories to read, some slideshows, restaurant recommendations, and lots of recipes. You check it out and like it.
Well, indeed.
Well, come on back next year and talk to us about the country cooking of Italy.
I would love to.
And in the meantime, have a wonderful holiday season.
Same to you.
Thanks, Coleman.
Thanks.
Time now for another commercial break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. And next up, we have a really wonderful Indian chef cooking in America, talking about, discussing his friend's book, who is a fabulous Indian chef cooking in India. And we get sort of a dual perspective on this. That was fun, wasn't it, Rabbit?
It was. Now, we're not going to try to pronounce the name of the chef himself who's in India. I think we tried doing the program, and you'll find it a rather unusual name. But a great introduction, anyway, to the wonderful world of cooking in this, I guess I could call it imperial.
I don't think that's a good idea.
Because it was for a while, but the cooking tradition has been going on a whole lot longer, of course, as you'll find out.
Suvir Saran is a chef, a food writer, a cookbook author, and obviously an Indian and an expert on Indian cuisine. And we've talked to him before. We talked about his book, American Masala, I believe. But at any rate, he's actually stepping in today to talk about Indian food in general, but stepping in for his, is it your friend, the author?
Fellow author, yes, Pushpesh Pant.
Pushpesh Pant. And this cookbook is viewed as the ultimate reference book for Indian cuisine. It's called India Cookbook. And it says on the front page, on the cover, the only book on Indian food you'll ever need. And that's
true? Very preposterous, I guess.
You think it's preposterous?
No, that's a good way of getting people to look at you and give you attention.
Well, he has 1,000 recipes, and my understanding is that the unique thing about it is that he covers all of the regions of India, which most books do not do.
Which is correct. He's covered many parts of India. I would be exaggerating if I said that the book covers every part of India, but it's exhaustive, it's wonderful in how many regions it covers, and to be honest, it doesn't cover every part of India. There are some states and regions which you couldn't get into because of travel, because of time, because of political strife, you know, the issues that keep you from covering everything. But it's in today's lingo, especially when we speak in a world where everybody is trying to be very American, it's easy to call something, the World Series, where, you know, we are competing only within America and we call it World Series. So this book is, in that way, it covers a lot, but it's not really, doesn't cover every region of India. I would be lying with you, so I'd have to...
It limits the recipes to traditional foods and doesn't cover the food scene in a modern context at all, right?
Correct. Your observation is totally astute.
But you're an Indian chef. So is this the kind of resource that you rely on?
I would not look at a book. I had such amazing memories and also a very large family within India and outside of India that for me my muse is the travels I do yearly to people of Indian descent, with people from India to different homes of Indian families. When I eat something at a table in a street in India, that is what I go to as a resource. But, you know, I'm hoping that when I have my child, and my child perhaps may not be as into learning about food through eating at a table or by traveling, they could use a book like this as a guide to discovering Indian food.
Well, there is a book out that I got at the same time as this called Indian Street Food, along with a really fabulous book on Thai street food. I mean, I thought
this year has been prolific in the quality and the amount of cookbooks that have come out. And the Indian street food is wonderful.
And the weight of them. I mean, they are so big and so heavy.
Oh, yeah, the Thai cookbook, you would kill yourself even before you would cook with it.
I know. We know him from Australia.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Is that David Thompson?
Yeah.
Yeah, David Thompson, yes.
Now, this book would make an impression if you dropped it on your foot.
No, don't do that to me.
If you dropped it in your foot, you would forever remember.
What you're going to do for us is you're going to help us navigate, or help our listeners to navigate through the world of Indian cuisine. How do we do that? It's so diverse. Are there any general principles you'd like to put out there?
Yeah, you know, it's a myth that Indian food is difficult, that Indian food has to be complicated, that Indian food is foreign. The reality of Indian cuisine for a non-Indian should be that there's nothing simpler than Indian cooking. It's just in our minds we think that the people who come from India have to be dressed in these flowing robes with bright colors, worshipping a million gods, and everything. Oh my God, that's so complicated. But the food of our country, the food of our people, the food of my motherland is perhaps the easiest and shockingly the richest, not in fat, but richest in flavor of food that anybody can find.
Oh, no, that's for sure, yes.
And Rose Levy Birnbaum, who's the author of Bread Bible, Cake Bible, Pastry Bible.
Oh, Rose, we
talk about preposterous names. As you know, her books, her work is exhaustive. She spends years perfecting one recipe. And Rose, when she talks about the cuisine that she can bow down to and say, wow, this is perhaps the penultimate cuisine, she considers Indian cuisine that.
Really?
But luckily, for somebody who accepts the cuisine as being amazing, the reality of our cuisine is that it's perhaps the most simple cuisine to have. What's difficult for Indian cooking is creating a pantry of spices, making those 10 minutes in your life to either shop online or bring maybe 20 minutes to think, where can I find an Indian store that I can go buy some spices at? Spices and the aromatics, it's perhaps there's no cuisine that comes as close in both giving you flavor and a punch of amazement than Indian food. So it's just finding those spices. And today, luckily in America, they're available in all 50 states. And in those states, there are many shops that sell Indian spices. And if you're lazy, you can even just go online, order them and get them to your doorstep.
But
the spices that are the difficulty for some people.
But Sabir, one of the things you can also do, and this book does that, is it tells you how to actually make your own spices.
And exactly. And I think it's a great way of indulging yourself in enjoying cooking, enjoying living, enjoying life. That, you know, yes, but still be... you have to still go and buy spices to make your own spices. Unfortunately, spices like kids cannot be immaculately conceived. And so we still have to go to a place to begin with the raw ingredients and then, yes, make your own blends, but you still have to buy the spices to make those blends.
Okay, so you start with some elemental spices and then you make a particular thing like garam masala, which is a combination of spices.
There's a whole chapter for that, the spice mixtures and paste.
Yeah, I looked at that. And then the next step, I guess, is to go into one of the other chapters in the book and say, okay, now this spice meets this ingredient. And the result is a finished dish.
Exactly. So in the spice chapter, one of the mixes that we have is called the sambar masala, which is a southern Indian mix of spices. Perhaps the closest, if any, Indian spice blend that we could say loosely is close to that horrible curry powder that the British created. And so Indians don't claim that, and when people say we love or hate curry, an Indian is cringing inside and thinking how oblivious the person telling you they love and hate curry is to the fact that curry is not Indian. The word curry in Indian cuisine refers to three things. One is that horrible powder, curry powder, that does nothing for our cuisine. We never use it, and it only tells us that the person telling us the love or hate curry is ignorant about Indian food. The other time we use the word curry is for a one ingredient called the curry leaf, which has nothing to do with that powder. It's not even an ingredient in that powder. And the third time we say the word curry is for a sauce, basically a gravy of any kind. Very loosely speaking, an Indian could be in Italy serving pasta with a marinara sauce and say, I'm having pasta curry today, which would just tell the other Indian eating it that this will be a dish of pasta with a sauce rather than just a pasta stir-fried with some dry ingredients. So, you know, it doesn't define a taste. It's just curry to us defines three things. The powder we do not eat, the powder that we never created, one leaf or a sauce. And the spices of India help us create a plethora of, you know, of sauces that could be from many different regions using ingredients of that region. And that's what the spice chapter helps you give, are the basic spice blends that would be found in different Indian regions, like garam masala, mostly in northern India. There would be a garam masala which we call khas garam masala, an aromatic garam masala, where, you know, we add in cinnamon and cloves and perhaps sometimes rose to make it even more floral than the usual garam masala. Chaat masala is the blend that we use in street food dishes. So you'll get, you know, if you have sweet potatoes in season, an Indian would take the sweet very quickly either deep fry those cubes to become like home fries, and when they come out of the oil, we'll sprinkle chaat masala. And all of a sudden, it becomes this amazing street food appetite. If you take sambar masala, the southern Indian spice blend that's on page 32 of this book, you can take it and make a stew with lentils and beans and legumes and then add vegetables into it and eat it with rice. And you get this perfect protein that the body can digest that's much healthier and more protein-enriched than even perhaps if you were eating something with chicken or beef. And it's better for your body. See, the spices create this, help you fill a canvas in your life that is just as boundless as your imagination.
So, well, what about the different colors of the pages? Is there
it's a way of just differentiating different chapters and for the book to have a little personality.
Can I ask you something? When you're not eating Indian food, what food do you gravitate to?
You are so bad. You're going to put me on the spot. My favorite, you know, when I'm not eating Indian, I am at home. If I'm eating at home, I'll be eating mostly Mediterranean, Southeast Asian, and Indian food.
Uh-huh.
If I'm outside of my house, if I'm eating with friends in a restaurant, again, I think I gravitate towards Middle Eastern, Moroccan, Lebanese, Italian.
Yeah.
And so for me, these are the foods that are very similar to Indian food in both simplicity and flavor. I'm not into Northern European cooking, which is the backbone of cuisine in North America. I am more into the Mediterranean cooking of Europe and Southeast Asia and South Asia.
Sabir, let me ask you a question. Do you know an Indian chef in London who owns a restaurant called Rasoi?
You know, we both know of each other. We've never met.
All right.
Of course, I know of him, yes.
So you know of him?
Yes, yes.
He's such a nice guy.
I've heard wonderful things about him.
Do you think that there will be a North American Indian restaurant that gets a Michelin star?
My restaurant is the only North American restaurant that's ever received a Michelin star.
Oh, so you have one already. Great.
Yes. And the people tell us that our cuisine is very similar in that we both do very authentic Indian cooking and we do it with great pride and we don't serve Americans what they are expecting or think of as Indian. We serve food that we grew up eating. So it's shocking to Americans that food that we serve could be Indian because it doesn't fit into that stereotype in their head. For Indians, it's the cuisine that they've grown up with. So I often get lectured by my guests that this is not Indian food. And I'm like, the India that I grew up with, but I'm sorry that I'm not giving you the India you want it to fit into. But it's,
excuse me. Well, we'll have to come and see you sometime when we're in New York, and we promise not to make that mistake.
Yesterday there was a person visiting from India, and they looked at the menu, and they said to me, "You are very cunning." And I said, "How am I cunning?" She said, "On the menu, you put chicken tikka masala as a side dish and charging whatever, I think I charged $16 or $18 for it." I said, "Yes, it's to teach people who order this rubbish." Firstly, I put it as a side dish. I charged three times what the local Indian restaurant in New York would charge for it. I said, I want them to understand why. It leads them into a conversation with the server or when I'm around with me, that why are you doing this? And I would tell them, because it's not meant to be eaten. This is garbage. You have to educate people in a subtle way. And sometimes that's when they wake up and realize, time for just giving up stereotypes and living and learning. And we go through a lot of effort. It's almost like my life would be easier if I didn't believe in Indian authentic food, because I could then just sit at home and do another business entirely. I got into this business because I missed the true, honest foods of India. And there was no cookbook when I arrived in America 18 years ago, none, by the pioneering chefs who helped pave the way for people like me today, that's authentic. Unfortunately, even the big divas of Indian cooking did disservice to Indian cooking by writing books that gave Americans the food they thought was Indian. So my burden when I came out with my first cookbook, Indian Home Cooking, was to share with the world a cookbook that Indians arriving into America could use as a cookbook that recreated mom and grandma and aunt's cooking right at the American kitchen without having substitutions or foolish ingredients added into a dish, because they thought, okay, if I make it authentic, an American won't understand it. It's, it's changed. I think the times are changing. The borders of the world are disappearing, and people are now increasingly getting more aware about different countries and peoples and traditions.
If you want to get into it in a big way and know that you have the encyclopedic resource, India Cookbook by your friend, whose name I won't even try to pronounce, is absolutely the book you must have. And Suvir, we thank you so much for joining us today on The Menu, and I hope our paths will cross soon.
Thank you for having me, Anand. It was a pleasure being here with you.
Well, I look forward to dining at Devi, too, because I've never done that.
I look forward to having you. Please don't be strangers.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye, Suvir.
And now another break, and we'll see you on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are and On the Menu, and what a treat, again, to interview Roseanne Gold, a cookbook writer who makes the writing of cookbooks seem like something flying off her fingers. Here's her latest book called Radically Roseanne, and I think you'll enjoy our discussion. One of the joys of doing On the Menu Radio is we get to talk to so many interesting people, find all kinds of interesting connections, which we just did with a cookbook author, award-winning chef, Roseanne Gold. And we're talking to her today about her book, Radically Simple, Brilliant Flavors with Breathtaking Ease. Now, that sounds perfect, Roseanne.
Well, I think it's very on trend for today. My goal in creating this book was to find a way to bring restaurant-quality food to the home kitchen and having it be as simple as possible.
Well, these photographs, they're absolutely beautiful. The dishes are beautiful, and the photographs reflect that, obviously.
Thank you. I thought it was very important to show that food at home can have a lot of grace and beauty. And part of the signature of the book, it's not so obvious, but every recipe can be expressed in 140 words or less. So, for example, you might look at the recipe. Yes, it's true. They're short. They have a variety of ingredients. Some recipes have only one ingredient, and some have 10. But it's a trade-off: time, number of ingredients, and ease of preparation.
You know, that's the one question we had. Could you just explain what you call this three-dimensional approach?
Absolutely. I think you may remember this, but I have written many cookbooks in the past, and many of those cookbooks were devoted to recipes that used only three ingredients. And that was another philosophy or attitude about cooking. The interesting thing was they were not always quick and easy. It was just a new exploration of taste using three elements. So I decided to play a little differently with this cookbook, and instead of limiting the number of ingredients, I wanted it to be a balance of time, ease, and the number of ingredients. So, for example, if a recipe had 10 ingredients in it, it might only have two lines of text, meaning you can throw everything in a pot and put it in the oven. A very good example of that is something I call whole buttered onion soup. It's one of my favorite recipes in the book, and you're not going to believe this, but you take 3 pounds of onions and your biggest covered casserole, and you peel them, and you put them in the pot, and you slice a stick of butter on top of those onions, you cover the pot, and you bake it for 4 hours. You can go to the movies, and you can come back, and you puree the onions with these gorgeous juices that have developed in the pot.
So you don't put any liquid in at all except what comes out of the onions.
Exactly.
Oh, wow.
And it is so gorgeous that the juices become almost mahogany or coffee or toffee colored, and then you puree it with a little bit of honey and a little bit of Madeira.
That sounds wonderful.
And it's gorgeous. So that's an example of, again, the three dimensions, 4 hours, but it's only a couple of ingredients, and it's easy as can be. There's one recipe, of course, you can only do this in summertime, but it's one ingredient. It's called my pink tomato frappe. And the story behind this was funny. Once I was doing a cooking demonstration at a beautiful farmer's market in New York City, the Union Square Market, and I forgot what I was making, but I ran out of food. And I'm thinking, oh no, there's a long line here. What am I going to do?
Oh dear.
So there was a farmer right next to me, and I said, give me a bushel of your tomatoes. And I just started pureeing the heck out of them in a blender, a rickety blender, and put some coarse salt. And everyone loved this. What is this? This is so dramatic. This is so delicious. And all it was pureed tomatoes. Now, what happens is that there's some pectin in the tomatoes, so very quickly it gets frothy. So it was almost like a little bit of a tomato mousse. So, of course, they thought it was brilliant.
Oh, that's amazing.
So did you actually cover the three dimensions?
Well, yes. Well, number of ingredients.
Okay, got it.
Time.
Got it.
And ease.
Now, one thing I noticed is you limit the description to 140
words,
so you have no excuse now not to read the recipe from beginning to end.
Exactly.
A common problem that some chefs have, some cooks have, in fact, Anne would even admit that she cooked something and she got all the ingredients together, and then it said, well, look, bake it for 4 hours?
Seven.
Hours.
It was Julia Child's, the choucroute garni.
And the guests were already there.
That's a wonderful story.
It was terrible.
But you know, I think we're all related in this respect. We love good food. We don't mind putting some effort into it. But when you look at a recipe and it has so many ingredients and 3 pages of text and it takes a long time to cook, then we do that just once in a while. So the goal here, there are 325 recipes and there are just so many wonderful things you can truly do even during the week.
They're just wonderful recipes, too. I mean, they're straightforward, but also with a little twist, like Moroccan carrots. Talk about being able to elevate a rather boring, usually boring ingredient. That's wonderful.
Yes, I love carrots. I do a lot of things with carrots.
So does Peter. Peter likes them, too.
And there's a recipe, something along the Middle Eastern route, the fact that you mentioned Moroccan carrots, called tortellini with yogurt, mint, and smoked paprika oil. And it's a version of an authentic recipe in Turkey called manti, which is pasta that is topped with yogurt. And this seems to have caught everyone's imagination. It's very interesting which recipes people tend to choose. I'm fascinated by that, either in my cookbook or other cookbook. What is it? Is it the photograph? Is it the unusual ingredient? Or is it the ease? So I think it's a combination of all of them. But this one, you just start with either fresh cheese or meat tortellini and olive oil, smoked paprika, garlic, mint. And it's on, like, if anyone reviews the book, everyone seems to go to this recipe. So that you can make that in 10 minutes. There's a whole chapter called 10-Minute Fresh Pasta Dishes. There's an entire chapter called 10-Minute Salads. There's a little section called 5-Minute Soups. And I like to use some unusual ingredients.
You do.
Like kimchi, but things you can find in a supermarket. I don't go to, quote, gourmet food stores very often. Everything is pretty much available.
You know, maybe we should back up a minute and just explain how you've organized this book.
Sure. Fairly traditional in the sense that there's a brunch chapter, 10-minute salads, soups, pasta, fish, poultry, meat, vegetables, side dishes, and dessert. That's the spine or the spirit of the book.
Right.
But within each chapter,
yes,
there are little leitmotifs. For example, in brunch, there's a little section called set up overnight. So I love the idea of, let's say, Saturday night, whipping up my pancake batter so it's usable for Sunday morning. And I call it overnight pancake. And I use self-rising flour and a little bit of baking powder. So they are so light and so fluffy. And what happens is that the leavening kind of slowly rises in the cold refrigerator overnight. So the next morning, the texture is gorgeous. And then there's even something called overnight tabbouleh. I love to eat tabbouleh, believe it or not, for breakfast. In the Middle East, they eat a lot of salad and cheeses and yogurt, grilled pita bread. I mean, I love that kind of breakfast.
That's my breakfast, too. I don't deal with breakfast foods at all. Cereals. I would never eat a cereal.
Okay. Well, sometimes I do, but this is really my preferred way. But the lovely thing about this tabbouleh, and of course you can eat it any time of the day, but you put all of the basically dry ingredients, the dried bulgur wheat, very finely chopped vegetables, in a bowl. And then you pour over some tomato juice, olive oil, and lemon,
ooh,
fresh lemon juice. And when you wake up in the morning, there's a lot of liquid. You think, oh, what's going to happen? But in the morning, the tabbouleh has basically made itself. It's exactly the right texture. The bulgur wheat has absorbed all of the liquid, and it's delicious. So there are a lot of interesting, innovative ideas. You know, I have been...
You are very innovative in general. I mean, where do you get that?
In the middle of the night. It comes to me, like everyone else, right? The night shift is working. That's what I say. Wake up with ideas. But I have been a professional chef for 30 years. And I see myself as the bridge between the restaurant kitchen and the home kitchen. For many years, I was the entertaining columnist for Bon Appetit magazine.
Uh-huh.
I did that for 5 years. And I kind of honed my skills there because I really needed to think about the cook at home, someone who really loved food, was knowledgeable, and wanted something a little bit different.
What's going to happen to Bon Appetit? Talk about that magazine.
I think it's going to become very celebrity-driven. I am not sure. They did just hire one of the most wonderful food writers in the world from the New York Times. I just read that a few days ago.
Who is it?
Her name is Christine Mulkey. She predominantly writes for the New York Times magazine section.
Okay.
But she will be going there, and Adam Rappaport, who was at GQ,
right. Exactly.
Is the new head.
Right.
So I think it's going to become a little slick and savvy, and it'll be
much more New York rather than California, so that's a change right there.
That's right.
You know, it puts it directly in competition with Food and Wine.
That is such a good point. That's exactly right,
yeah.
Because Bon Appetit, like Sunset Magazine, right? These were had more of a West Coast sensibility.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Mm. That'll be interesting to see. So, do Twitter?
I just started, but I need help. Listen, I'm an older person. I don't know how to do anything.
It's too complicated. But we have that. I haven't interviewed her yet, but we have that cookbook. What's it called? Tweet Eat.
Something like that.
Which is all the recipes are in 140 characters.
Exactly. You know, there was an article a couple of years ago that talked about one woman, I don't know, in Europe who was tweeting her recipes. And it was really fun. But it's rather exhausting, and it really presupposes a lot of knowledge. Not only of that kind of new vocabulary, right?
Yeah.
Of just short phrases, but you need to bring a lot of knowledge and skill.
Oh, yeah. I mean, writing a cookbook is, I mean, I did one only for a chef. And I'll tell you, it was the most exhausting thing I ever worked on.
Yes, chef recipes are really tough.
Oh, especially the pastry chef recipe.
Oh, yes. I don't do that very well. I'm happy to say with Radically Simple, it was just chosen this week as one of the top 10 cookbooks of the year by the New York Times. So
oh,
I was really
good.
Delighted. And
I don't think I saw that list. I've seen so many lists, it's hard for me to sort through.
Yeah.
Either trends or cookbooks. So, and of course, trends is something you're familiar with also because of your work with Weitman,
predominantly we are restaurant consultants and do projects all over the world. I suppose we were best known for having created Windows on the World on top
right.
of the World Trade Center, and also we owned and operated the Rainbow Room for many, many years in New York. But right now my thing is really cookbooks. Radically Simple is actually my 12th cookbook, and I think it may be my last one for a while. It is very difficult work.
That was my next question. What are you working on was my next question, Roseanne.
Well, interesting. I do have a blog. 2 months ago, I started a blog. I write every morning. I call it my morning meditation, and I'm enjoying that. And
where do people find that?
Well, it's www.roseannegold, but I spell my name a little funny, R-O-Z-A-N-N-E-G-O-L-D, roseannegold.wordpress.com.
Got it.
And they can write, they can check in every morning.
Right. Now, Peter started the blog, but he just can't get directed to doing it every day.
No, I'm just not.
Once a year is almost too much.
Just not that into coming up with a thought every morning like you. I have thoughts, but they're not necessarily about food.
Oh, then I would really want to read yours. You know, food can be very limiting. I'm sure you have many interesting things to share.
Oh, dear. Well, this has been wonderful, and the individual recipes, I don't know how we convey that. We've talked a little bit about them, but the individual recipes are just absolutely just unique, just about. I mean, it's not humdrum stuff.
Well, they're
simple, but not humdrum.
I think they're ingenious.
They're not just
ingredient driven. The preparations are innovative and easy. You must have done a lot of experimenting to be able to work out how these things all work.
This book took years to write.
Oh, yeah. I mean, shaved fennel with Parmigiano and hot pepper salad, warm wild mushrooms on hummus. I mean, it goes on like that. It's just amazing that you come up with so many things with not going to really strange ingredients.
I'm going to have to throw all the other cookbooks away so I can concentrate on this one.
Oh, yeah. Peter Cooks.
Well, they'll be this week. Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us today, and congratulations on this great book and making the New York Times top 10.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Roseanne.
Well, what a delight it was to have these four people on our program today and share our conversation with you. We hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.